Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 338, Connecting the Dots, Part 5. This is another program on the subject of the terrorist blitzkrieg of September 11th. I've done many other programs on this subject. Time permitting, I will tell you where to get those programs and or descriptions with annotated references. I will do that at the end of the program. Now, in For the Record program number 337, The Protocols of the Elders of Oil, Part 2, we dealt with a woman named Helms, first name Layla or Layli. She was described as the Taliban's public relations representative in the United States. She also was described as the niece of former CIA director Richard Helms. That turns out to be slightly incorrect. She is married to the nephew of former CIA director Richard Helms, but she was indeed the Taliban's PR representative in the United States, and I don't think it would be an unreasonable question to ask and an unreasonable supposition to voice that her professional resume, so to speak, suggests very strongly that she may have been associated with a CIA-associated institution that was assisting the anti-Soviet Mujahideen during the anti-Soviet Afghan War of the 1980s. That war, of course, saw the genesis of Osama bin Laden as a warrior. The following article is from the New York Times of Tuesday, November 27th of the year 2001. This article is by Alessandra Stanley. It's headlined, "She Spoke for Taliban and Now Pays a Price," and it reads in part as follows. Until September 11th, the most vocal advocate in the United States for the Taliban was a woman. She is Layli Helms, 38, who seems an incongruous champion for other reasons as well. An Afghan-American whose grandfathers were both ministers under the deposed King Mohammad Zahir Shah, Ms. Helms is married to a nephew of a former CIA director, Richard Helms. Since the Taliban took power in Afghanistan in 1996, Ms. Helms has acted as their unofficial liaison to the West, publicly defending their policies, and, she said in a recent interview, privately urging them to steer a more moderate course. Before the September 11th attacks in the United States, her support of the Taliban was startling to some, but nobody described it as treasonous, skipping down. But journalists who have worked with her in Afghanistan in the past describe her as well-connected, indeed, I would add parenthetically, well-informed and reasonable. So did Milt Bearden, who was the CIA station chief in Peshawar in the 1980s when the United States was supplying the Mujahideen, the tribal fighters who were fighting the Soviet-backed government. Quote, "We forget that her association with the Taliban began at a time when even the United States saw them as a welcome change," he said. Again quoting, "I saw hers as an impassioned freelance involvement." Skipping down, I would add, take that with a grain of salt. Ms. Helms was born in Kabul to a wealthy upper-class family, but her family left for Paris and then when she was three for New Jersey. They returned to Afghanistan when she was nine, then back to New Jersey when she was a teenager. She attended Fairleigh Dickinson University in New Jersey. At 22, she became executive director of Friends of Afghanistan, an association of Afghan expatriates and Americans opposed to the Soviet occupation. In 1988, she and her husband moved to Peshawar as aid workers. Again, one wonders to what extent Ms. Helms was involved with U.S. intelligence and the Afghan support effort. Organizations like Friends of the Afghans are a frequent vehicle for various covert operations and intelligence community support mechanisms abroad. One should again be cautious of oversimplifying the attacks of September 11th. As I've said before, and the supplemental discussion to many of the items I'm going to be talking about will be out of the scope of a half-hour broadcast, and number 338 will be a half-hour. I refer interested listeners again to the tape duplication service Spitfire, which can get CDs and tapes of the other programs. Also, sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, which is archiving the programs on Real Audio. And on the Spitfire website, there are annotated descriptions of the programs, detailed annotated descriptions with sourcing. Those are currently up to date. The number 337, the program I recorded last week, is already up on the web. By the way, this broadcast is being recorded on December 2nd of the year 2001. As I stated in a number of broadcasts dealing with September 11th, I believe that the operational milieu that was involved with the attacks on the United States, in fact, involve elements that have worked, ostensibly at least, with and for the United States, but that in fact doubled on the United States. A very important and thought-provoking article on just such a U.S. intelligence operative who was involved with Al-Qaeda and, in point of fact, doubling on the United States, was carried in the Wall Street Journal of Monday, November 26th of the year 2001. This is an article by Peter Waldman, Jerry F. Seib, Jerry Markin, and Christopher Cooper, again from the Wall Street Journal of Monday, 11/26/2001. It's headlined, "The Infiltrator, Ali Mohammed Served in the U.S. Army and Bin Laden's Circle." Subtitled, "Lapses in Handling Sergeant Mirror Larger Failings in FBI's Terror Policy." The first clue, the article reads in part as follows. The first clue came back in 1989 in a field out. The first clue came back in 1989 in a field outside New York City. There, within view of a secret Federal Bureau of Investigation surveillance camera, stood five Arab men taking target practice at a rifle range. At the time, the FBI wrote them off as harmless zealots, fired up to help the Mujahideen fighting the Soviet puppet government in Afghanistan. What the FBI didn't know was that the young Arabs had a special coach, a U.S. Army sergeant from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, named Ali Mohammed, who had been giving them paramilitary training in a nearby New Jersey apartment. And one other thing the agents didn't know until much later, Mr. Mohammed was a longtime member of a radical Islamic militant group banned in Egypt for assassinating President Anwar Sadat. In retrospect, it is now clear that the FBI had stumbled onto a deadly serious terrorist organization on U.S. soil, one that would eventually be absorbed by Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network. All five of the target shooters were later convicted on conspiracy charges related to the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and its aftermath. And the mysterious Mr. Mohammed would appear over and over again, Zelig-like, as Al-Qaeda grew into a genuine threat to American national security. The Sergeant Saga, like the evolution of the broader terrorist threat to America, is the story of intermittent successes, missed clues, and bungled opportunities. The FBI used Mr. Mohammed as an informant at times, extracting from him its first known comprehensive briefing on Al-Qaeda all the way back in 1993. And again, I believe that the September 11th attacks is not an event to be oversimplified. There are elements of U.S. intelligence that were genuinely working against Al-Qaeda, but as the late John O'Neill, who was in charge of the FBI's investigation into Al-Qaeda, concluded before he was killed in those attacks, in fact, the investigation was being frustrated by American corporate ties to Saudi Arabia and oil, and that, in fact, Saudi Arabia was deeply involved in bankrolling Islamic fundamentalism. And I believe that behind that, in turn, and cooperating with that, is what I call the Underground Reich. More about that later. Skipping down in the article, in 1986, after talking about Mr. Mohammed's background with the Egyptian Army Special Forces, in 1986, Mr. Mohammed parlayed his old U.S. Army ties into a spot as an Army supply sergeant and occasional lecturer on Mideast culture at the U.S. Army's Special Warfare School in Fort Bragg, a place where he'd studied earlier as an Egyptian officer. His role there came at a time when the U.S. military was eager to learn more about the Islamic, and moving to an inside page, His role there came at a time when the U.S. military was eager to learn more about the Islamic world. Little is publicly known about his stint there, which lasted until 1989. An Army spokesman declined to comment, and people who knew him there weren't given permission to speak. His new friends back home in California took for granted that Mr. Mohammed was helping the Central Intelligence Agency in its proxy war against the Soviets in Afghanistan. At the time, the anti-Soviet jihad was a worldwide cause among Muslims. Quote, "Everyone in the community knew he was working as a liaison between the CIA and the Afghan cause, and everyone was sympathetic," unquote, says Ali Zaki, a San Jose, California obstetrician who was close to Mr. Mohammed and his American wife, a medical technician named Linda Sanchez. the CIA declines to comment. And as I've indicated in many of the broadcasts, I believe that the milieu that was used against the Soviets in Afghanistan, including the Grand Mufti-founded World Muslim Congress, was equally opposed to the United States, and then, in combination with the Underground Reich, doubled on the United States. Skipping down again, talking about FBI surveillance of Mr. Nasser, a member of this Islamic terrorist network in the New York area. Mr. Nasser assassinated the American Rabbi Meir Kahane, the founder of the Koch Party in Israel, a Zionist extremist party in Israel. Continuing and skipping down, had officials looked more closely, they would have found an early and startling chain of relationships. Mr. Nasser was part of a local group inspired by Sheikh Omar Rahman and was determined to wage jihad against the U.S. The group was closely connected to the Al-Kifa Refugee Center in Brooklyn, an office that originally was set up to help the anti-Soviet Mujahideen, but was turning into an Al-Qaeda front. And they would have found that Mr. Muhammad was part of the group. Instead, Mr. Muhammad was free to begin his odyssey into the heart of Al-Qaeda. In 1991, he told a New York federal court years later, a request came into the Brooklyn Al-Kifa office. Could he travel to Sudan to help Mr. Bin Laden set up his base of operations there? He went. A year later, he was off to Afghanistan to help train Al-Qaeda operatives in intelligence, military, and explosive methods. Then, a new and much more frightening terror strike finally prompted investigators to dive back into Mr. Nasser's boxes of information. At 12:17 p.m. on February 26, 1993, a truck bomb exploded on the B-2 level of the World Trade Center parking garage. New York's tallest buildings had been hit for the first time, and six people died. A handful of men were arrested and ultimately convicted in the bombing. Along the way, investigators discovered that some of the plotters had a relationship with Mr. Nasser, and they went back to look at his personal possessions. There, they finally saw the link to Mr. Muhammad, and they began to see they were dealing with a network of would-be terrorists, all seemingly inspired by Sheikh Omar, not a couple of stray car bombers. And as federal investigators were about to discover, they were terrorists intent on striking again. In May 1993, 3 months after the bombing, Sheikh Omar was speaking with one of his disciples at his Jersey City, New Jersey apartment when the man asked whether it would be acceptable in Islam to bomb the FBI's Manhattan headquarters. Now listen to the following. This from an FBI wiretap transcript. Quote, slow down a little bit, the Sheikh cautioned, whispering for fear the FBI was bugging his apartment, which it was. Quote, the one who killed Kennedy was trained for 3 years, unquote. It was never made clear in later court testimony which assassination the Sheikh was talking about. This, of course, is very thought-provoking indeed. The context is not altogether clear. I would note that the official assassin of Robert F. Kennedy was a Palestinian Arab, Saran Saran. And I would also note that there are evidentiary tributaries connecting the various assassinations that we had in the 60s, both Kennedy's and Martin Luther King. One of the names connected with a drug smuggling and intelligence ring involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King and allegedly the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. One of the names involved with that was a fellow named Fuad Habash, who was the brother of George Habash, one of the founders of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, one of the Palestinian terrorist organizations, connected with the Underground Reich and with the fascist Third Position, opposed to both the former Soviet Union and the United States. And again, it's my belief that the executive authority in the assassinations was in fact what I call the Underground Reich. Note also that there are evidentiary tributaries connecting the Oklahoma City bombing and the first World Trade Center bombing and the second attacks on the World Trade Center on September 11th, and that in turn those crimes are connected with the AMIA bombing, or at least there are evidentiary tributaries connecting them with the AMIA bombing in Argentina. More about that later. Skipping down again, speaking of the World Trade Center bombers from 1993, The bomber's paramilitary trainer, Mr. Muhammad, was highly educated, having earned two bachelor's degrees and a master's degree at the University of Alexandria in Egypt. Ramzi Youssef, the calculating mastermind of the bombing, was found in Pakistan in a house paid for by the Bin Laden Network. It turned out that he was closely associated with a Saudi Arabian businessman named Muhammad Jamal Khalifa, who happens to be Mr. Bin Laden's brother-in-law. Skipping it down again. The FBI located Mr. Muhammad near San Francisco in 1993, where he volunteered the earliest insider description of al-Qaeda that is publicly known. In his chat with the FBI, court documents in the embassy bombings case show, Mr. Muhammad said Mr. Bin Laden was running a group called al-Qaeda, quote, and was building an army, unquote, that might be used to overthrow the government of Saudi Arabia. He also told the Bureau he had trained terrorists at Mr. Bin Laden's military camps in Sudan and Afghanistan. Yet even though that interview occurred after the World Trade Center blast and after Mr. Muhammad's U.S. training manuals had already been found in Mr. Nasser's possession, Mr. Muhammad was let go without further investigation. Skipping down again. Soon enough, Mr. Muhammad skipped off to Africa on what turned out to be a deadly Bin Laden mission. As he later admitted in court documents, Mr. Bin Laden asked him in 1993 to go to Africa to conduct surveillance of American, British, French, and Israeli targets in Nairobi. I took pictures, drew diagrams, and wrote a report, he testified. He took his research to Sudan, where Mr. Bin Laden then had his headquarters. The terrorist leader, quote, looked at the picture of the American embassy and pointed to where a truck could go as a suicide bomber, unquote, Mr. Muhammad said. A plot to blow up American embassies in Africa, which would mark a turn by al-Qaeda to far more sophisticated operations, was well underway. By 1993, al-Qaeda had established a cell of operations in Kenya. Much as the September 11th hijackers moved in and out of the U.S. for a couple of years, the embassy bombers moved in and out in waves, some conducting surveillance of the embassy, others making preliminary targeting decisions, and still others bringing in supplies to prepare for the attack. The same African cell planned the attack on the U.S. embassy in Tanzania. Even as those plots were falling into place, the FBI was continuing to talk to Mr. Muhammad, never apparently getting a full picture. When prosecutors in the Trade Center conspiracy trial wanted to speak with him, agents working through an intermediary tracked him to a safe house in Nairobi. He told authorities that he had taken a job in the scuba diving business, failing to mention his involvement in the surveillance of al-Qaeda targets. 2 years later, at an interview in October of 1997, he gave agents a detailed account of how he trained Mr. Bin Laden's bodyguards, and how al-Qaeda operatives in Somalia helped attack U.S. troops in the early 1990s, causing American deaths, according to court papers. He said he had trained people in, quote, war zones, and war zones can be anywhere, unquote. He also told the FBI that one did not need a fatwa or a ruling from an Islamic religious leader to, quote, to go against the U.S., since it was, quote, obvious, unquote, that the U.S. was the enemy, unquote, court papers say. Still, the U.S. investigators didn't get wind of the African embassy plot, despite Mr. Muhammad's role in it. Finally, in nearly simultaneous attacks on August 7, 1998, the terrorists exploded truck bombs at the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. Skipping down again, also found were instructions on where to plant bombs to blow up buildings and how to encode messages for secrecy that visit Mr. Muhammad's home in Sacramento. A week later, prosecutors subpoenaed Mr. Muhammad to testify before a federal grand jury investigating al-Qaeda in New York. Afterward, he was taken into custody. Quote, for 5 years, he was moving back and forth between the U.S. and Afghanistan. It's impossible the CIA thought he was going there, beginning again, quote, for 5 years, he was moving back and forth between the U.S. and Afghanistan. It's impossible the CIA thought he was going there as a tourist, said Egypt's Mr. Nabil Sharif, a former intelligence officer and a university professor. Again, quoting, if the CIA hadn't caught on to him, it should be dissolved and its budget used for something worthwhile, unquote. Again, the possibility of a fifth column is one to be very seriously considered here. I note that because of the connection to Sheikh Rahman. I would also note that one of Sheikh Rahman's sons was just arrested, apparently, in Afghanistan and is now in custody of U.S. Allied forces. San Francisco Chronicle, Thursday, November 29th of 2001, has the following story by Bob Drogan and Josh Meyer of the Los Angeles Times. It's headlined, Operative's Father Was Convicted in Bomb Plot, and it reads in part as follows. Anti-Taliban forces in Afghanistan apparently have captured their biggest known trophy to date, a top al-Qaeda operative who was the son of an extremist Muslim cleric convicted in 1995 of conspiring to blow up New York landmarks, U.S. intelligence officials said yesterday. Ahmed Abdel Rahman, 35, ran a key terrorist training camp in Afghanistan, the official said. He is being held at an undisclosed location as the Pentagon and Afghan opposition leaders weigh what to do with a growing number of prisoners belonging to Osama bin Laden's terror network. It remains to be seen what happens with the son of Sheikh Rahman. I would note that he's going to be represented by, among others, none other than Ramsey Clark, the attorney general who helped to frustrate Jim Garrison's investigation into the Kennedy assassination and then attributed the assassinations of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King to lone nuts before any investigation had been undertaken. We're going to take a look now at an article from the Los Angeles Times of Tuesday, November 13th of 2001, about a Syrian connection to Osama bin Laden. This is an article by Michael Slackman of the LA Times, headlined Family Ties That Bind and Bedevil, state-lined Latakia, Syria, and reads in part as follows. Najwa Ghanem's family is terribly worried about her safety. Not only is the mother of 11 living in the Taliban-controlled section of Afghanistan, she is married to the world's most wanted man, Osama bin Laden, skipping down. The Ghanem family has a double-sided bond to bin Laden. His wife and her siblings are also bin Laden's first cousins, a common phenomenon in the clannish world that exists both in Saudi Arabia and among the extended families of this part of western Syria. Skipping down. While much attention has been focused on bin Laden's Saudi ties, his Yemeni father, who founded a Saudi construction empire, his 53 brothers and sisters, who control a multi-billion-dollar fortune, bin Laden's maternal line has been comparatively ignored. His mother, Aliyah, comes from a working-class family that is largely secular. Ghanem, bin Laden's first wife, is the daughter of Aliyah's brother. They married when she was 14 and he was about 18. And skipping down of this small town in Syria, where his wife comes from, bin Laden's, that is, this city of 320,000 is a stronghold of the Alawite sect, an offshoot of Islam that controls Syria's government and security forces. That would then go back to Manzur al-Kassar, an operative not only in the Iran-Contra affair, but also an individual whose name has been connected to the AMIA bombing in Argentina in 1994. The Syrian power elite is also connected with the milieu of former Argentine President Carlos Menem. We talked about that in For the Record program number 328, among others. And in number 330, we talked about links to the AMIA bombing. We're going to come back to the Syrian power elite, its connections to Argentina, the milieu of the AMIA bombing, and Manzur al-Kassar in future broadcasts. I would note that one of the institutions allegedly connected to al-Qaeda was the Al-Taqwa Financial Company, and that a member of its board of directors, Ahmed Huber, is a Swiss-born, Schweizerdeutsch, so to speak, fascist, and an associate of Johann von Leers in Egypt, an individual who was in charge of anti-Semitic propaganda for Josef Goebbels' ministry in the Third Reich. We talked about Ahmed Huber and Al-Taqwa in For the Record program 335. Mention of the Al-Taqwa milieu and its connections to bin Laden was carried in a Financial Times article of Thursday, November 29th of the year 2001. This is an article by Mark Huband, Huband, headlined Bankrolling Bin Laden, and it reads in part as follows, skipping down. Since September 11th, such global links have continued to be unearthed. In early November, U.S. authorities included Altaqua, a Swiss-based financial services company, on its third list of accounts to be frozen because of suspected links to terrorism. Galeb Himat, the company's 63-year-old Tunisian-born executive and a board member of the Geneva section of the Kuwait-based International Islamic Charitable Organization, or IICO, was also on the list. Himat denies any connection with Islamic militancy. However, a German intelligence report says the Munich-based Islamic Community of Germany, whose president is Himat, expressed, quote, pleasure, unquote, over the September 11th attacks at a closed meeting. Much of the military experience of the current generation of fighters who have joined al-Qaeda was gained in Bosnia, where Muslim forces and communities have received millions of dollars of funding from Iran, Saudi Arabia, and other countries, skipping down. Saudis pumped more than $600 million into Muslim efforts in Bosnia, $380 million of it from individual donations, the rest from the government. And as I noted in Among Other Programs, For the Record Program 330, the president of Bosnia, Alija Izetbegović, was a member of the 13th Waffen-SS Division as a young man that was recruited by the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who also founded the World Muslim Congress, one of the major institutions involved in the anti-Soviet war in Afghanistan in the 80s. T.W. Bill Carr, a British intelligence analyst, wrote a paper entitled German and U.S. Involvement in the Balkans, A Careful Coincidence of National Policies. This was presented at a symposium on the Balkans War in Chicago that was held on August 31st and September 1st of 1995. And of Alija Izetbegović, a member of the 13th Waffen-SS Division as a young man, he writes, Alija Izetbegović, who had been released early from jail in 1988, serving only 6 years of a 14-year sentence for pro-Islamic, anti-state activities, visited Islamic fundamentalist states in the Middle East, returning to Bosnia-Herzegovina to found the SDA, Muslim Party of Democratic Action. His 1970 manifesto, Islamic Declaration, advocating the spread of radical pan-Islamism, politicized Islam throughout the world by force if necessary, was reissued in Sarajevo at this time. And we'll continue the discussion of his Islamic declaration, Alija Izetbegović, that is, in terms of the context of our discussion of Islamofascism in future broadcasts. This, however, concludes For the Record program number 338, Connecting the Dots, Part 5. This is being recorded on December 2nd of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.